strength, and possibly even better. The people who do this are missing a couple of crucial pieces of information. The subjects in these studies are untrained, and the results seen in untrained subjects simply can't be directly extrapolated to trained subjects. Newbie gains are very real and boil down to the simple fact that your muscles respond exceptionally well to just about any type of training for the first 3 to 6 months. Simply put, you can make all kinds of mistakes in the beginning and still make better than average progress. This doesn't last long, though. Once the magic runs out, it's gone forever, and what worked for the first few months won't necessarily continue to work. This is especially true in resistance training. While an untrained subject can make mediocre strength and muscle gains on machines for the first few months, there's no way in hell he can build an impressive physique by primarily working on machines. There is research that proves the opposite. Free weights are indeed more effective at building muscle and strength than machines. A good example is a study conducted by researchers from the University of Saskatchewan, which demonstrated that the free weight squat resulted in 43% more leg muscle activation than the Smith machine squat. Another example is a study conducted by researchers from the University of California that demonstrated that the free weight bench press resulted in greater activation of the upper body muscles than the Smith machine bench press. These things shouldn't come as a surprise. For decades, the most impressive bodybuilders have always emphasized free weight training, and I'll bet that the biggest, strongest guys in your gym do the same. The bottom line is that there's just something special about forcing the body to freely manipulate weight, unaided, against the pull of gravity. Nobody ever built a great chest by just pounding away on the pec deck and machine press. It always took years of pushing around barbells and dumbbells. Not all free weight exercises are equal, though. The most effective ones are known as compound exercises, and they involve and activate multiple muscle groups. Examples of powerful compound exercises are the squat, deadlift, and bench press, which train a lot more than just the legs, back, and chest, respectively. The opposite of a compound exercise is an isolation exercise, which primarily involves and activates just one muscle group. Examples of isolation exercises are the cable fly, which isolates the chest muscles, dumbbell curl, which isolates the biceps, and leg extension, which isolates the quadriceps. When it comes to building size and strength, numerous scientific studies have confirmed the superiority of compound exercises over isolation exercises. One such study was conducted at Ball State University in 2000, and it went like this. Two groups of men trained with weights for 10 weeks. The first group did 4 compound upper body exercises, while the second group did the same plus bicep curls and triceps extensions, isolation exercises. After the training period, both groups increased strength and size, but which do you think had bigger arms? The answer is neither. The additional isolation training performed by group 2 produced no additional effect on arm strength or circumference. The takeaway isn't that you shouldn't directly train your arms, but rather that by overloading your entire body, you cause everything to grow. Charles Poliquin, trainer to world-class athletes like Olympians and professional sports players, is fond of saying that to gain an inch on your arms, you have to gain 10 pounds of muscle. His point is that the most effective way to build a big, strong body is with systemic overload, not localized training. If your weightlifting program isn't built around heavy, compound training, you're never going to achieve your genetic potential in terms of overall muscle size and strength. Now, I'm not saying that all isolation exercises are worthless. Certain isolation exercises, if properly incorporated into a routine, do help with overall development. In fact, they're necessary for fully developing smaller muscles in the body, like the shoulders, biceps, and triceps. So you will find a few isolation exercises in my program, but they are hardly the emphasis. Myth and mistake number 4, constantly changing up your routine. Guys who make the mistake of doing lots of ineffective exercises often believe the muscle confusion myth, which is the belief that you have to constantly change up your routine to keep your body guessing and make gains. This is complete nonsense. You're in the gym to get bigger and stronger, and that requires four simple things. Do the right exercises, lift progressively heavier weights over time, eat correctly, and give your body sufficient rest. Regularly changing exercises simply isn't necessary because your goals limit the exercises that you should be doing. You see, if you're looking to build a solid foundation of muscle and strength, you should do the same types of exercises every week, and they will include things like squats, deadlifts, bench presses, dumbbell presses, military presses, and others. If you do these exercises correctly every week, your strength will skyrocket, and you'll gain muscle faster than you've ever imagined possible, without changing a single thing other than the amount of weight on the bar. Furthermore, constantly changing your routine prevents you from properly evaluating your progress. How can you know whether you're getting stronger if you're doing different exercises and rep ranges every week or two? You can't, and that's dangerous. That leads to week after week of busting your ass without ever realizing that you aren't progressing at all. Myth and mistake number 5, lifting like an idiot. One of the most painful sights in gyms is the ego lifters spastically throwing around big weights with reckless abandon. I cringe not only out of pity, but also out of the anticipation of injuries that could strike at any moment. While this might sound like another shocking generality, it's nonetheless true. Most guys don't have a clue about proper form on many exercises, and this ignorance stunts their gains, causes unnecessary wear and tear on ligaments, tendons, and joints, and opens the door to debilitating injuries, especially as weights get heavy on the shoulders, elbows, knees, and lower back. Some of these guys just don't know any better, and some are more interested in looking cool than in making real gains. Others were just taught wrong by, yes, you guessed it, magazines, friends, or trainers. Well, you're not going to fall into this trap. You're going to do your exercises with perfect form, and while your weights may be lighter than Mr. Huff and Puff, he'll secretly be wondering why you're moving up so quickly in your lifts while he's been stuck for months. Myth and mistake number 6, lifting like a wussy. Building a great body is a pain in the butt. It takes considerable time, effort, discipline, and dedication. It doesn't come easy, and anyone who tells you otherwise is either ignorant or lying. Quite frankly, most guys just train like wussies. They don't want to face up to heavy weights and do the hard work. They seem to believe that just showing up and going through the motions is enough. Well, it's not, and their bodies, which change little over time, are a testament to that fact. The truth is, these guys are just giving in to one of our most primal instincts. We humans are programmed to avoid pain and discomfort and seek pleasure and ease in life. And in some circumstances, this works out nicely for us. If we let these inclinations color our workouts, however, we're doomed. If you want to build an impressive physique, you're going to have to work hard in the gym. You're going to have to move weights that are just downright intimidating. You're going to have to dig deep to finish that last set. You're going to deal with muscle soreness and other aches. But you're going to come to love it. You're going to learn that these hardships are just part of the game, the dues you have to pay to meet your goals. You're going to look forward to this daily hour of intense, uncomfortable, all-out physical exertion because you know that every workout you finish makes you a little bit stronger, both physically and mentally, and gets you a little bit closer to the end game. Myth and mistake number 7, eating to stay small or get fat. As you've probably heard, your muscles grow outside of the gym when they're provided sufficient rest and proper nutrition. Well, many guys get it all wrong. They overtrain and then don't eat enough calories, or protein in particular, or eat way more food than they should, and eat too much non-nutritious food and wonder why they can't get their bodies to change the way they want. You see, if you don't eat enough calories and get enough protein every day, you simply don't grow. It doesn't matter how hard you lift. If you don't eat enough, you won't gain any muscle to speak of. On the other hand, if you eat enough protein but too many calories every day, you can gain muscle, but it will be hidden underneath an ugly sheath of unnecessary fat. If you don't eat enough nutritious foods, you can change your body composition, but eventually you'll develop vitamin and mineral deficiencies that impair both your health and performance, which in turn will limit your gains over time. When you know how to eat properly, however, you can gain eye-popping amounts of muscle while staying lean, and you can lose layers of fat while maintaining or even increasing your total muscle mass. The bottom line. You've just learned the path to muscle-building misery. Grind away for hours in the gym. Do tons of burnout sets. Do the wrong exercises with bad form. Avoid pushing yourself too hard and eat incorrectly. These mistakes are responsible for untold amounts of frustration, discouragement, and confusion. They're the prime reasons why guys make little or no gains and quit. So if that's how to do it wrong, how do you correctly go about building muscle and losing fat? Continue to find out. Chapter summary. More is not always better in weightlifting. Many popular bodybuilder routines result in overtraining for a natural weightlifter. As a natural weightlifter, you must emphasize heavy compound weightlifting if you want to maximize your results. High rep routines that emphasize isolation exercises are extremely ineffective in the long run. Getting a huge pump doesn't stimulate nearly as much muscle growth as you might think. You don't have to constantly change up your exercise routine to make gains. Instead, you want to progressively increase your strength on key compound lifts. If you want to build an impressive physique, you're going to have to work hard in the gym. Easy workouts don't do much. If you chronically undereat, you won't grow any muscle to speak of. If you chronically overeat, you will build muscle but will gain too much body fat. Chapter 6. The Three Scientific Laws of Muscle Growth. Fortunately, there is a solution, and it's not performing multiple sets of whatever cable Kegel exercise is being pushed as the answer. Just a little hard, smart, basic work. Jim Wendler. The laws of muscle growth are as certain, observable, and irrefutable as those of physics. When you throw a ball in the air, it comes down. When you take the correct actions inside and outside the gym, your muscles grow. It's that simple, regardless of whether your genetics are good or bad. There's no such thing as the hopeless hard gainer. There are only people who don't know and act in accordance with the laws contained in this and the previous chapters. These principles have been known and followed for decades by people who built some of the greatest physiques we've ever seen, going all the way back to the likes of Steve Reeves and Roy "Reg" Park, and even further back to the pioneering father of modern bodybuilding, Eugene Sandow. Some of these laws will contradict things you've read or heard, but fortunately, they require no leaps of faith or meditation. They are practical. Follow them, and you get immediate results. Once these rules have worked for you, you will know they're true and will never be lured away from them. The first law of muscle growth, progressive overload overall. As you know, the burn you feel is simply an infusion of lactic acid in the muscle, which is a byproduct of muscles burning their energy stores. It does little to induce muscle growth. A big pump is also not a good predictor of future muscle growth. The pump you feel when training is the result of blood being trapped in the muscles. And while it's a good psychological boost and studies have shown that it can help with protein synthesis, the process by which cells build proteins, it's not a primary driver of growth. What drives muscle growth then? The answer is known as progressive tension overload, which means progressively increasing tension levels in the muscle fibers over time. That is, lifting progressively heavier and heavier weights. You see, muscles must be given a powerful reason to grow, and nothing is more convincing than subjecting them to more and more mechanical stress and tension. This makes good intuitive sense. To adapt to handling heavier and heavier weights, the muscles must grow larger, and it's also supported by science. For example, in a meta-analysis of 140 related studies, researchers from Arizona State University found that a progression in resistance optimizes strength gains and muscle growth. Researchers also found that working in the 4 to 6 rep range, 80% of 1 rep max or 1 RM, is most effective for those who train regularly. The conclusion of this research is simple. The best way to build muscle and strength is to focus on heavy weightlifting and increase the weight lifted over time. Well, that's not just theory, that's fact. And that's what the Bigger, Leaner, Stronger program is all about, lifting heavy weights and doing short, intense sets of relatively low numbers of reps. Leave the drop sets, giant sets, and super sets prescribed in the magazines to the magazine readers. Those training methods are as ineffective for building muscle as they are grueling. It's a lot of work for little reward. Instead, from now on, you're going to train differently. You're going to spend more time resting than you're used to. You're going to perform exercises you're probably not used to, and you're going to lift a lot more weight than you thought possible. But the payoff is huge. You're not only going to come to love your workouts, but you're also going to love how your body changes even more. The second law of muscle growth. Proper rest is just as important as proper training. One of the most common problems with the many weightlifting programs out there is they simply have you doing too much, whether in individual workouts or in total weekly training volume. They play into the common misconception that building muscle is simply a matter of pounding your body into submission through excessive amounts of training. People who have fallen into this bad habit need to realize that if they did less of the right thing, they would get more. You see, when you lift weights, you cause tiny tears in the muscle fibers, known as micro tears, which the body then repairs. This is part of the process by which muscles grow, scientifically termed hypertrophy. One of the things you want to achieve with your workouts is an optimal amount of micro tearing in the muscles. Not so much that your body falls behind with repair, as this stunts muscle growth, but not so little that you miss out on potential gains. While many guys undertrain and thus underdamage their muscles, many more overtrain and overdamage them. That is, the individual workouts they do result in too much micro tearing, or they wait too few days before training a muscle group again, given the extent of the muscle damage caused in the previous workout. Studies have shown that, depending on the intensity of your training and your level of fitness, it takes the body 2 to 7 days to fully repair muscles subjected to weight training. Considering the volume and intensity of the Bigger, Leaner, Stronger program, we can safely assume full muscle recovery is going to take 4 to 6 days. The third law of muscle growth. Muscles will grow only if they're properly fed. You could do the perfect workouts and give your muscles the perfect amount of rest, but if you don't eat correctly, you won't grow, period. It is that cut and dry. A proper diet isn't particularly complicated, but it does have several moving parts that you need to know how to coordinate. Sure, we all know to eat protein, but how much? How many times per day? Which kinds? What about carbs? Are they good for muscle growth? Which kinds are best? How much? When should you eat them to maximize your gains? And dietary fats? What role do they play? How much do we need, and what are the best ways to get them? And last but not least, how many calories should we eat every day and why? When do we adjust this and by how much? Well, these are all good questions, and in this book you're going to find definitive answers to all of them, and more so that you never make a diet mistake again. The bottom line, packing on slabs of rock-solid lean mass is, in essence, just a matter of following these three laws religiously. Lift hard and heavy, get sufficient rest, and feed your body correctly. That's how you build a strong, healthy, ripped body. And soon you're going to be on your way, proving it to yourself and others. So then, let's now flip to the other side of the fitness coin, losing fat, and see what myths, mistakes, and laws await. Chapter summary. Progressive overload is the primary driver of muscle growth, not fatigue or pump. Working primarily with 80 to 85% of your 1RM optimizes strength gains and muscle growth. Recovery time is just as important as training time, and studies have shown it takes the body 2 to 7 days to fully repair muscles subjected to weight training. Chapter 7, The 5 Biggest Fat Loss Myths and Mistakes. The road to nowhere is paved with excuses. Mark Bell. For thousands of years now, a lean, muscular body has been the gold standard of the male physique. It was a hallmark of the ancient heroes and gods, and it has remained a revered quality. It has been idolized in pop culture, achieved by few, but coveted by many. With obesity rates over 35% here in America, and steadily rising, it would appear that getting shredded and becoming one of the physical elite must require superhuman genetics or a level of knowledge, discipline, and sacrifice beyond what most people are capable of. Well, this simply isn't true. The knowledge is easy enough to understand. In fact, you're learning everything you need to know in this book. Sure, it requires discipline and some sacrifice in that no, you probably don't have the metabolism to eat a large pizza every day and have a six-pack. But here's the kicker. When you're training and dieting correctly, you'll enjoy the lifestyle. You'll look forward to the gym every day. You'll never feel starved. You'll get to eat food you love, and you won't suffer from overpowering cravings. When you find this sweet spot, you'll look and feel better than you ever have before and find it infinitely more pleasurable and valuable than being lazy, fat, and addicted to ice cream and potato chips. When you can get into this zone, you can do whatever you want with your body. The results are inevitable. It's just a matter of time. Most people never get there, though. They either lack the will or desire to get there. They don't have their inner game sorted out, or they lack the know-how required to make it happen, or both. Well, in this chapter, we're going to address the five most common myths and mistakes of getting ripped. Like the muscle-building fallacies, these errors have permeated the health and fitness space and mucked things up for millions of people. Let's dispel them, once and for all, so that they can't block your path to achieving the lean, muscular body that you desire. Myth and mistake number one, watching caloric intake is unnecessary. If I had a penny for every person I've spoken with who wanted to lose weight but didn't want to have to count calories, well, you know the rest. This is about as logical as wanting to drive across the state without paying attention to the gas tank. Could you do it? Maybe. But it's going to be a lot trickier and more stressful than it should be. Now, I won't be too hard on these people because they often don't even know what a calorie is. They just don't want to be bothered with having to count something or worry about whether they can afford one food or another, and I can understand that. Here's the truth, though. Whether you want to call it counting calories, meal planning, or something else, to effectively lose fat, you have to regulate your food intake. You see, the metabolism is an energy system and operates according to the laws of energy. Losing fat requires that you keep your body burning more energy than you're feeding it, and the energy potential of food is measured in calories. Chances are this isn't news to you, but I want to quickly review the physiology of fat loss, just in case you're not convinced that fat loss boils down to the mathematics of energy consumed versus energy burned. The underlying scientific principle at work is energy balance, which refers to the amount of energy you burn every day versus the amount you give your body via food. According to the laws of physics underlying this principle, if you give your body a bit more energy than it burns every day, a portion of the excess energy is stored as body fat, and thus you gain weight slowly. If you give your body a bit less energy than it burns every day, it will tap into fat stores to get the additional energy it needs, leaving you a bit lighter. You see, any given time, your body requires a certain amount of glucose in the blood to stay alive. This is vital fuel that every cell in the body uses to operate, and certain organs, like the brain, are real glucose hogs. When you eat food, you give your body a relatively large amount of energy, calories, in a short period. Glucose levels rise far above what is needed to maintain life, and instead of throwing away or burning off all excess energy, a portion is stored as body fat for later use. Scientifically speaking, when your body is absorbing nutrients eaten and storing fat, it's in the postprandial state. Post meaning after, and prandial meaning having to do with a meal. This fed state is when the body is in fat storage mode. Once the body has finished absorbing the glucose and other nutrients from the food, amino acids and fatty acids, it then enters the post-absorptive state, after absorption, wherein it must turn to its fat stores for energy. This fasted state is when the body is in fat-burning mode. Your body flips between fed and fasted states every day, storing fat from the food you eat and then burning it once there's nothing left to use from the meals. In the bonus report that comes with this book, you'll find a simple graph that depicts this cycle. This is the fundamental mechanism underlying fat storage and fat loss, and it takes precedence over anything related to insulin or any other hormones or physiological functions. Simply put, you can't get fatter unless you feed your body more energy than it burns, and you can't get leaner unless you feed it less energy than it burns. Contrary to, currently, popular belief, it doesn't matter how many carbohydrates you eat or how high your insulin levels are throughout the day. Energy balance is the first law of thermodynamics at work. Fat stores can't be increased without the provision of excess energy, nor can they be reduced without the restriction of energy. That's why research has shown that so long as they're eating less energy than they're burning, people lose fat equally well on high-carbohydrate or low-carbohydrate diets. The bottom line is that the types of foods you eat have little to do with losing or gaining weight. In this regard, a calorie is a calorie. That isn't to say that you should eat nothing but junk food to lose weight, however. What you eat does matter when we're talking about maintaining optimal body composition. If you want to lose fat and not muscle, a calorie is not a calorie, but we'll talk more about that later. So with that out of the way, let's get back to calorie counting. What people usually dislike most about it isn't the counting, but the trying to figure out what to eat while on the run every day or what to buy when rushing through the grocery store. When you have a 30-minute window for lunch and run to the nearest restaurant, you don't want to have to load an app and try to estimate calories. You want to just order something that sounds healthy and hope for the best. Unfortunately, these quick, healthy meals have hundreds more calories than you might think. Repeat that for dinner with a few random snacks thrown in for good measure, and you've simply eaten too much to reduce your total fat mass. You'll have stored just as much, if not more, fat as you burned, and your weight will remain the same or go up accordingly. So the real problem isn't counting calories, but failing to make and follow a meal plan that allows you to eat foods you like while ensuring that you burn more fat than you store over time. Sure, it's easier to just heat up a big plate of leftovers or grab some fast food for lunch and carry on with your day, but that convenience comes with a price, little or no weight loss. Myth and mistake number two, do cardio and you'll lose fat. Every day I see overweight people grinding away on the cardio machines, and week after week goes by with them looking the same. They are under the false impression that grinding away on an elliptical machine or stationary bike will somehow flip a magical fat loss switch in the body. Well, as you now know, that's not how it works. Cardio can enhance fat loss in two ways, burning calories and speeding up your metabolic rate, but that's it. And since I brought it up, let's talk briefly about the metabolic rate. Your body burns a certain number of calories regardless of any physical activity, and this is called your basal metabolic rate, BMR. Your total daily energy expenditure, TDEE, for a day would be your BMR plus the energy expended during any physical activities. When your metabolism is said to speed up or slow down, what this means is that your basal metabolic rate has gone up or down. That is, your body is burning more or fewer calories while at rest. Cardio, especially a variety I recommend called high-intensity interval cardio, HIIT, can increase your basal metabolic rate through what's known as the afterburn effect. While that sounds fancy and is often used in sketchy marketing pitches for sketchy products, it's simple. Your body continues burning additional energy after you exercise. But here's the thing with cardio. If you don't also eat correctly, that nightly run or bike ride won't save you. Let's say you're trying to lose weight and have unwittingly eaten 600 calories more than your body has burned for the day. You go jogging for 30 minutes at night, which burns about 300 calories, with maybe another 100 calories burned from the afterburn effect. You're still 200 calories over your expenditure, and that means no reduction in total fat stores for the day, and maybe even an increase. You could continue like this for years and never get lean. Instead, you could slowly get fatter. This is the most common reason why people simply can't lose weight no matter what they do. Myth and mistake number 3. Chasing fad diets. The Atkins diet, the South Beach diet, the paleo diet, the HCG diet. This one makes me cringe. The Hollywood diet, the body type diet. It seems like a new fad diet pops up every month or two. I can't keep up these days. While not all latest and greatest diets are bad, paleo is unnecessarily restrictive but quite healthy, for example. The sheer abundance of fad diets being touted by ripped models and actors is confusing people as to what the right way to lose weight is, and understandably so. The result is that many people jump from diet to diet, failing to get the results they desire. And they buy into some pretty stupid stuff simply because they don't understand the physiology of the metabolism and of fat loss like you now do. Or they don't want to accept it. Regardless, the rules are the rules, and no fancy diets or snake oil supplements will help you get around them. As the old saying goes, the best diet is the one you can follow. And as you'll see, a flexible, balanced approach to eating is by far the most enjoyable and thus the most effective. Once you experience this for yourself, you'll fully realize how asinine many of the fad diets taking gyms by storm are. Myth and mistake number 4. Doing tons of reps gets you shredded. Many gurus recommend that you follow a high rep, low weight routine to shred up. But this is the complete opposite of what you want to do. The reality is that your body is primed for muscle loss when you're in a calorie deficit, and by focusing exclusively on muscle endurance, higher rep ranges, you'll set yourself up for rapid strength loss, with the potential for significant muscle loss as well. The key to preserving strength and muscle while losing weight is to lift heavy weights. The goal is to continue progressively overloading your muscles, which ensures protein synthesis rates remain elevated enough to prevent muscle loss. There are fat loss benefits to heavy weightlifting as well. A study published by Greek sports scientists found that men who trained with heavy weights, 80 to 85% of 1 RM, increased their metabolic rates over the following 3 days, burning hundreds more calories than the men who trained with lighter weights, 45 to 65% of 1 RM. Yes, hundreds more calories. That's significant. And if you want to really score extra calories burned, focus on compound lifts like squats and deadlifts, because these are the types of lifts that burn the most post-workout calories. The bottom line is getting that shredded look is just a matter of having a fair amount of muscle and a low amount of body fat, and nothing else. There aren't any special exercises that bring out the striations, and burning your muscles out with tons of reps does nothing to improve your overall look. Myth and mistake number 5, trying to spot reduce fat. Pick up just about any fitness magazine, and you'll find workouts for getting a six-pack, slimming the thighs, getting rid of love handles, and the like. I wish it were that simple. While research has shown that training a muscle results in increased levels of blood flow and lipolysis, the breakdown of fat cells into usable energy in the area, it's not in a large enough quantity to matter. The reality is that training the muscles of a certain area of your body burns calories and can result in muscle growth, both of which certainly can aid in fat loss, but it doesn't directly burn the fat covering them to any significant degree. You see, fat loss occurs in a whole body fashion. You create the proper internal weight loss environment, a calorie deficit, and your body reduces fat stores all over the body, with certain areas reducing faster than others. You can do all the crunches you want, but you'll never have a six-pack until you've adequately reduced your overall body fat percentage, and that's more a function of proper dieting than anything else. Ironically, if you want an area of your body to be leaner, training the muscles without also ensuring you're reducing your body fat percentage will only aggravate the problem. The muscles will grow, but the layer of fat will remain, which will only result in the area looking bigger and puffier. I often run into this with women who get into weightlifting without also addressing their body fat percentage. This is why many women believe weightlifting makes them bulky. They started weightlifting to look lean, toned, and athletic, not to have even more trouble fitting into their clothes. This is why I often repeat a simple rule of thumb. The more muscle you build, the leaner you have to be to avoid looking big and bulky. A woman who has built an appreciable amount of muscle, one or more years of weightlifting, will want to stay at or under 20% body fat to maintain the athletic look of toned arms, a tight stomach, shapely legs, a big butt, etc. For us guys, we need to stay at or under 10% for the look we're usually after. Fully visible abs, small waist, vascularity, dense-looking muscles, etc. Now, we all have our fat spots that plague us, and that's just genetics for you. Some guys I know store every last pound in their hips, while others are fortunate to have their fat accumulate more in their chest, shoulders, and arms more so than their waistline. Rest assured, however, that you can lose as much fat all over your body as you want, and you can get as shredded as you want. You'll just have to be patient and let your body lean out in the way it's programmed to. The bottom line. Like building muscle, many people approach fat loss completely wrong and thus fail to achieve their weight goals. But just like building muscle, the laws of healthy fat loss are very simple and incredibly effective. Carry on to learn the laws and how to put them to work for you. Chapter summary. The principle of energy balance underlies all weight loss and gain. The types of food you eat have little to do with losing or gaining weight. What you eat does matter in terms of body composition, however. If you want to lose fat and not muscle, a calorie isn't a calorie. Your body flips between fed and fasted states every day, storing fat from food you eat and then burning it once there's nothing left to use from the meals. If you store just as much fat as you burn every day, your weight stays the same. If you store more fat than you burn by overeating, you get fatter. And if you burn more fat than you store, you get leaner. Doing a bunch of cardio isn't enough to get lean. You simply can't out-exercise a poor diet. The best diet is the one you can follow. This is why a flexible approach to dieting is the only one that works in the long run. The key to preserving strength and thereby muscle while losing weight is to lift heavy weights. Training the muscles of a certain area of your body burns calories and can result in muscle growth, both of which certainly can aid in fat loss, but it doesn't directly burn the fat covering them to any significant degree. Chapter 8. The Four Scientific Laws of Healthy Fat Loss. For me, life is continuously being hungry. The meaning of life is not simply to exist, to survive, but to move ahead, to go up, to achieve, to conquer. Arnold Schwarzenegger. Evolution has taught the body that having fat means being able to survive the times when food is scarce. Many thousands of years ago, when our ancestors were roaming the wilderness, they often journeyed for days without food, and their fat stores were all that kept them alive. Starving, they would finally kill an animal and feast, and their bodies knew to prepare for the next bout of starvation by storing excess energy as fat, as it was literally a matter of life and death. This genetic programming is still in us. When you restrict your calories for fat loss purposes, your body reduces its total fat stores to stay alive, but it also slows down its basal metabolic rate to conserve energy. If you restrict your calories too severely or for too long, this metabolic downregulation or metabolic adaptation, as it's often called, can become quite severe and the basal metabolic rate can plunge to surprisingly low levels. This mechanism is why calorie counting seems to not work for some people. It has nothing to do with hormone problems or eating too many carbs or anything other than the fact that the energy out part of the equation is impaired. Their bodies aren't burning nearly as much energy as they should be. This is only the beginning of the problems with the crash approach to dieting, however, that has you enduring severe calorie deficits for extended periods. You lose a lot of muscle, which not only leads to the dreaded skinny fat look, but it also impairs bone health and increases the overall risk of disease. Your testosterone levels plummet and cortisol levels skyrocket, which not only makes you feel horrible, but also accelerates muscle loss. Your energy levels take a nosedive. You struggle with intense food cravings every day, and you become mentally clouded and even depressed. Fortunately, you can fix the metabolic adaptation and all the other negative effects of low-calorie dieting by slowly increasing food intake over time, and thus bringing your basal metabolic rate back to a healthy level. But the real goal is to prevent it altogether, and that's what we're going to focus on in this chapter, the laws of healthy fat loss that, when followed, allow for consistent weight reduction without major metabolic slowing or muscle loss. The first law of healthy fat loss: eat less energy than you burn to lose fat. As you now know, fat loss is just a science of numbers. No matter what anyone tells you, getting ripped boils down to nothing more than making a simple mathematical formula work for you: energy consumed versus energy expended. Contrary to much of the mainstream advice these days, it doesn't matter what you eat. If your metabolism is healthy and you set your calorie intake correctly, if you maintain a moderate calorie deficit by eating a bit less energy than you burn every day, you will lose weight. Don't believe me? Professor Mark Hobb from Kansas State University conducted a weight loss study on himself in 2010. He started the study at 211 pounds and 33.4% body fat, overweight. He calculated that he would need to eat about 1,800 calories per day to lose weight without starving himself. He followed this protocol for 2 months and lost 27 pounds, but here's the kicker. While he did have one protein shake and a couple of servings of vegetables each day, two-thirds of his daily calories came from Twinkies, Little Debbie's, Doritos, sugary cereals, and Oreos, a convenience store diet, as he called it. And he not only lost the weight, but his bad cholesterol, or LDL, dropped 20%, and his good cholesterol, or HDL, increased 20%. Of course, Hobb doesn't recommend this diet, but he did it to prove a point. When it comes to fat loss, calories are king. This is nothing new in the scientific study of weight loss and energy balance. Metabolic research on human calorie expenditure stretches back nearly a century, and by now, the entire physiology is fully understood. A fantastic review of the subject can be found in a paper published by researchers at the University of Lausanne, in case you want to dive into the fairly complicated details. As you also know, healthy fat loss isn't as simple as drastically cutting your calories and starving yourself. Eventually, the muscle loss, metabolic slowdown, and other undesirable effects become too much. Finally, after you can't take the misery anymore, you'll likely go in the other direction, dramatically increasing calorie intake by binging and gorging on everything in sight for days or weeks, and wind up back where you began. In fact, you can end up even worse off. This vicious cycle has been shown to result in rapid fat storage, often beyond pre-diet body fat levels. In other words, people end up fatter than when they started dieting in the first place. So the bottom line is this: you will need to watch your calories to effectively lose weight. You'll have to stay disciplined and forego the snacks and goodies not worked into your meal plans. You'll probably have to deal with some hunger now and then. But if you do it right, you can get absolutely shredded without losing muscle, or even while gaining muscle. Yes, this can be done. More on that later. The second law of healthy fat loss: use macronutrients properly to optimize your body composition. As I mentioned earlier, while a calorie is a calorie for weight loss purposes alone, a calorie is not a calorie when it comes to optimizing body composition. What you eat matters very little if you're just trying to see the number go down on the scale, but it matters very much if you're trying to lose fat and not muscle. If you eat too little protein while restricting calories for weight loss, you'll lose more muscle than you would if you had eaten an adequate amount. If you eat too few carbohydrates while in a calorie deficit, your training will suffer, your muscle repair will be impaired, and your hormone profile will become more catabolic. If you eat too little dietary fat, you can experience a significant drop-off in testosterone levels and other undesirable effects. As you can see, if you want your weight loss regimen to be maximally effective, You want to restrict your calories, but also eat enough protein and carbohydrate to preserve muscle mass and performance, and enough dietary fat to maintain healthy hormone levels as well as general health. Adequate dietary fats are necessary to maintain healthy skin and hair, insulate body organs against shock, regulate body temperature, and promote healthy cell function. While that sounds complicated, it's not. In fact, it's probably the simplest way of going about dieting, and you'll learn all about it later in this book. The third law of healthy fat loss. Eat on a schedule that works best for you. Most meal timing advice calls for eating multiple small meals per day, and the reason often given is that eating like this will speed up your metabolism and thus help you lose weight faster. It seems to make sense at first. By putting food in our bodies every few hours, it has to constantly work to break it down, which should speed up our metabolism, right? Well, kind of. But it doesn't help with weight loss. You see, each type of macronutrient, protein, carbohydrate, and fat, requires varying amounts of energy to break down and process. This is known as the thermic effect of food and is the metabolic boost that comes with eating. The magnitude and duration of that boost depends on how much you eat. A small meal causes a small metabolic spike that doesn't last long, whereas a large meal produces a larger spike that lasts longer. So the question, then, is whether eating more smaller meals per day increases total energy expenditure over a 24-hour period than fewer larger meals. Well, in an extensive review of literature, scientists at the French National Institute of Health and Medical Research looked at scores of studies comparing the thermic effect of food in a wide variety of eating patterns, ranging from 1 to 17 meals per day. In terms of 24-hour energy expenditure, they found no difference between nibbling and gorging. Small meals cause small, short metabolic boosts, and large meals cause larger, longer boosts. By the end of each day, they balanced out in terms of total calories burned. We can also look to a weight loss study conducted by researchers from the University of Ontario, which split subjects into two dietary groups, 3 meals per day and 3 meals plus 3 snacks per day, with both in a caloric restriction for weight loss. After 8 weeks, 16 participants completed the study, and researchers found no significant difference in average weight loss, fat loss, or muscle loss. So eating more, smaller meals doesn't directly help or hinder fat loss. What about appetite? Can it help there? A study conducted by scientists at the University of Missouri with 27 overweight, obese men found that after 12 weeks of dieting to lose weight, increasing protein intake improved appetite control, but meal frequency, 3 versus 6 meals per day, had no effect. Researchers from the University of Kansas investigated the effects of meal frequency and protein intake on perceived appetite, satiety, and hormonal responses in overweight, obese men. They found that higher protein intake led to greater feelings of fullness and that eating 6 meals resulted in lower daily fullness than 3 meals. On the other hand, you can find studies that found participants were less satiated on 3 meals per day and that increasing meal frequency improved their feelings of fullness and made it easier to stick to their diets. The bottom line is that many variables are involved with the appetite, including psychological ones, and our hunger patterns are established by our regular meal patterns, so it's usually easiest to work around this, not against it. This is why clinical evidence shows that both more and fewer meals per day are effective for weight loss and have no inherent drawbacks or advantages in terms of metabolic rate and appetite control. Let's now talk about a boogeyman that scares dieters everywhere. Late-night eating. Somehow many people believe that eating too much food later in the day will accelerate fat storage, so they avoid it at all costs, preferring to go hungry for hours on end over shifting meals around to better suit their hunger patterns. Well, as you now know, fat loss and gain depend wholly on energy balance and have nothing to do with meal timing. This means you get to eat as late as you want. This isn't just theory either. It's been proven in multiple scientific studies. For example, a study conducted by researchers at the University of Chieti in Italy found that calorie intake in the morning or evening didn't affect weight loss or body composition parameters. a study performed by researchers at Vanderbilt University demonstrated interesting results. Subjects who normally ate breakfast lost more weight by skipping it and eating the majority of calories at dinner, whereas subjects who normally skipped breakfast lost more weight by eating breakfast every day. Researchers chalked this up to greater levels of satiety and thus better dietary compliance. Another study on the matter, this time from researchers at the University of Sao Paulo in Brazil, showed that splitting calories into 5 equal meals per day eaten between 9 a.m. and 8 p.m., eating all calories in the morning and eating all calories in the evening didn't affect weight loss parameters or body composition. I've also put this research to the test many times, both in my own meal planning and with people I help and work with, sometimes jamming large portions of our daily calories into late-night dinners, whether out of necessity or choice. As expected, it made no difference in our results. So long as you stick to your daily numbers, your body will respond just as it should. While we're on the subject of late eating, I recommend that you eat 30 to 40 grams of a slow-digesting protein like egg or casein, either from a powder or from a whole food source like low-fat cottage cheese, 30 minutes before going to bed, as research has shown that this improves muscle recovery due to the increased availability of amino acids for repair while you sleep. So, the long story short is that you don't need to be a slave to a rigid meal schedule. Eat as frequently or infrequently as you like, because when you eat has little bearing on your ability to lose fat. Use meal timing as a tool to make your dieting as enjoyable and convenient as possible. This way, you can stick to your diet, which is what matters in the end. Now, if you're wondering where to start, with more or fewer meals per day, I recommend that you eat several smaller meals per day. 4 to 6 meals per day works well. In my experience coaching thousands of people, most are like me and prefer the experience of eating more small meals as opposed to fewer large ones. I personally don't like eating between 800 and 1,000 calories to then feel stuffed for several hours. I much prefer a 400-calorie meal that leaves me satisfied for a few hours, followed by another smaller meal of different food. If you already know that you don't want to or can't eat that frequently, then don't sweat it. Do whatever will work best for you. The fourth law of healthy fat loss. Use exercise to preserve muscle and accelerate fat loss. You can lose weight by restricting calories without exercising, but adding exercise, both resistance and cardiovascular training, comes with some major benefits. The addition of resistance training to a calorie deficit preserves muscle and BMR, and it provides a substantial afterburn effect. Adding cardiovascular training burns more energy and thus more fat. In my opinion, restricting calories for weight loss without also doing some form of resistance training to preserve muscle is just a mistake. It's going to result in at least mild muscle loss, and this not only isn't good for looks, but it's bad for your health too. Cardio is negotiable. There's nothing inherently unhealthy or bad about not including it in your weight loss regimen, but I'll tell you this. You will only get so far with diet and resistance training alone. If you're planning on getting below 10% body fat, I can pretty much guarantee that you're going to need to include some cardio in your routine to get there. Fortunately, however, you won't have to do nearly as much as most people think. The bottom line. Healthy fat loss depends on these four laws and no others. Drugs and invasive surgeries aside, any and all workable weight loss methods rely on the four simple rules you just learned to achieve results. Sure, you can get fancy and count points instead of calories, restrict your food choices to the point where you simply couldn't overeat if you tried, come up with all kinds of creative low-calorie recipes, use tricks to increase satiety and curb hunger, and so on. But in the end, these laws will either work for or against you and will determine whether you lose weight. Chapter summary. When you restrict your calories for fat loss purposes, your body reduces its total fat stores to stay alive, but it also slows down its basal metabolic rate to conserve energy. A calorie is not a calorie when it comes to optimizing body composition. If you want your weight loss regimen to be maximally effective, you want to eat enough protein and carbohydrate so as to preserve muscle and performance capacity, and enough dietary fat so as to maintain general health. increasing or decreasing meal frequency doesn't help or hinder weight loss or muscle growth. Eat on a schedule that works best for you. Eating at night doesn't help or hinder weight loss or muscle growth. Eating a slow-digesting protein like egg or casein, either from a powder or from a whole food source like low-fat cottage cheese, 30 minutes before going to bed improves muscle recovery. The addition of resistance training to a calorie deficit preserves muscle and BMR, and it provides a substantial afterburn effect. The addition of cardiovascular training burns more energy and thus more fat. Section 2. Inner Game. Chapter 9. The Inner Game of Getting Fit. Discipline is doing what you hate to do, but nonetheless doing it like you love it. Mike Tyson. When it comes to getting fit, there's something odd about the 3-month mark. It's when I see so many people quit. I've seen it time and time again with dozens of people. They make it to 3 or 4 months and, for one reason or another, just disappear. Some got sick and never returned. Others decided to take a week off, and it turned into a permanent break. Others were just plain lazy and started making excuses as to why they didn't care about being in shape anymore. Most of these people had one thing in common, though. They weren't happy with their gains, and without enough visible results for their efforts, it's understandable that their motivation waned. Fortunately for you, you're not going to have this problem. If you follow exactly what you learn in this book, you'll make incredible gains and will feel more motivated after 3 months than you do right now. Before we get into the nuts and bolts of proper training and diet, however, I want you to know that there are two equally important aspects of achieving the body of your dreams. I call them the outer and inner games of getting fit. The outer game is the physical stuff, how to train, eat, rest, and so on. And this is what most trainers, books, and magazines focus on. The inner game, however, is less discussed but equally important. If you don't have this squared away, you'll be in for a rough ride. The inner game is, of course, the mental side of getting and staying fit, and this is what sets apart the people with great physiques from those with mediocre ones. Building a killer physique is not a matter of jumping on the bandwagon of some new fad workout program for a few months. It's a matter of adopting a disciplined, orderly approach to how you handle your body, and it's quite a lifestyle change for most. The two biggest inner game barriers are lack of motivation and lack of discipline, and most people have to wrestle with them at some point, and usually sooner than later. What I often see is people starting their fitness plans with tanks full of resolve, but within only a few weeks, they're already running low. That new TV show is starting during gym time. That extra hour of sleep would hit the spot. A few days off isn't a big deal. Another cheat meal shouldn't hurt too much. Giving in to these temptations sends you down a slippery slope of getting less than great results, which then leads to wondering why you're even bothering with it all, which naturally leads to quitting. I've seen it over and over and over. Well, while it's true that some people are just more naturally disciplined than others, anyone can use the simple tricks I'm going to share in this section of the book to help get mentally prepared to win and to stay the course even when tempted to go astray. Chapter 10. How to Become Your Own Master. The Simple Science of Willpower and Self-Control. Would you have a great empire? Rule over yourself. Publius Syrus. According to a 2010 survey conducted by the American Psychological Association, the lack of willpower is the number one obstacle people face in achieving their goals. Many feel guilty about their lack of self-control, like they're letting themselves and others down, and that their lives are, in large part, not under their control. They report feeling like their actions are dictated by emotions, impulses, and cravings, and that exerting self-discipline ultimately just leads to exhaustion. And what about those with higher levels of willpower? Well, they do better in school, earn more money, make better leaders, and are happier, healthier, and less stressed. They have better social and romantic relationships, they can keep their mouth shut, and they even live longer. The bottom line is, no matter the circumstances, more willpower trumps less. Regardless of where we generally fall in the spectrum, we all have willpower challenges to face. Some are biological in nature, the desire to eat greasy, sugary foods that our brains recognize as vital to our survival, and others are more uniquely ours. What we find tempting, someone else might find repulsive. Their addictions might be as appealing to us as airline food. Whatever the details, the machinations are the same. Your excuse for skipping the gym, again, is remarkably similar to the foodie's justification for binging. For the third day in a row, how you talk yourself into putting off that important work just one more day is how